This is a Defocus Media production. Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the ODs on Facebook podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Faiz Mahjoub, and on this episode, we're taking a deep dive into vision development. I'm honored to be joined on this episode by a living legend in optometry, Dr. Glenn T. Steele, known affectionately among colleagues as Bubba. Dr. Steele is a developmental optometrist and professor at the Southern College of Optometry Pediatric Service. He is a past president of both the College of Optometrists in Vision Development, COVD, and the Optometry Extension Program Foundation, OEPF, as well as past chair of the American Optometric Association's Infancy and Children's Vision Committees. Dr. Steele has lectured extensively in the area of vision development and has received numerous awards for his work in the area of infant and child development. Among these honors was his induction into the National Optometry Hall of Fame in 2019. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode today, Bubba. One thing that I think is pretty interesting anytime I'm talking to a developmental optometrist is the concept of a model of vision and how they've kind of gathered their knowledge and experience and created that into a context that guides their way of thinking. So I was just really curious to hear about what your thoughts are on that and what your model of vision would be.
I think my model of vision was formed shortly after I graduated. Had an opportunity to do a fellowship at the Gazelle Institute of Child Development in New Haven, Connecticut, and I spent a year there with just four or five incredibly sharp people, Dr. Ames and Dr. Ilge. Dr. Ilge was a pediatrician, Dr. Ames was a psychologist, and then John Streff and Dick Appel, who were optometrists, and they became my mentors and helped shape and form the kinds of things that I do. Primarily, I believe that vision develops. It's not something that happens. And therefore, if it develops, it can be guided. It can be guided by parents. It can be guided by optometrists. It can be guided by family in positive or negative way. But most of all, it's guided by the child's internal curiosity. And it starts probably starts before birth, but we can't assess it until after birth. And so it begins there. And depending on what they look out and see and how encouraged they are to reach out and get things determines how well and how sophisticated their process of vision becomes. I see so many patients who are not able to engage in life in general. And, you know, we all know those kind of people who are very introverted, not willing to step out and make changes. And then we as optometrists intellectually understand about vision and its development, but sometimes we all lose sight of the impact that vision can have in overall development. And that's been a real key probably in the last 15 years being involved with infancy, because I've explored all kinds of things outside of optometry and eye care to see that vision is such a brain hog and it touches so many aspects of overall development that optometrists should definitely be at the table when any decisions, when any discussion is taking place about child development, because vision is so important. It's so connected to all aspects. For instance, one example is there's a researcher at University of Washington named Andrew Meltzer, and one of the things that he has discovered, and he's not an optometrist or an ophthalmologist, he's a vision researcher. Actually, it's in language, but he has discovered that if a baby looks at the parent and sees the parent looking at a target, and they follow that gaze by 12 months of age, then at 18 months of age, they'll know and understand 335 words. If they don't follow the parent's gaze and don't learn to do that and don't engage vision so much, they only understand and respond to 197 words. And to me, that's significant because it's talking about language development even before they can talk and say any words really at all, rather than just babbling sounds. So that to me started me looking much, much deeper. I read that about 15 years ago, or I'm not sure exactly the date, but several years ago. And it started me looking at all other kinds of processes.
That's really impressive. It sounds like vision is an early marker for overall cognitive development and not just eyesight, as we sometimes kind of think of it as being its primary role.
That is absolutely correct. It involves so many things. And one of the things I've done with that is think of vision as a reach. And in my seminars, I'll hold up a target and have somebody touch it. And I'll ask the audience, how accurate were they? And they said they were real accurate. And I'll say, now look at it. And how accurate were they? And you don't know. You don't know what the quality of their reach is. And I differentiate those two things by talking about hearing versus listening. You can hear sounds, but all of a sudden you start listening. You attend in a different way. You touch certain things, but then all of a sudden you start feeling it, and a baby in the course of development begins to feel things in a different way. Smells can come in, but then you intently smell. And in the same way, light comes into your eye all the time, but until you turn and focus your attention and look, when you do that, it becomes a different thing. Another one would be tasting. You can have a taste in your mouth, but then developing a taste like a wine tasting, a wine connoisseur, can tell you the various qualities of the wine. Whereas if you just taste it, you know, the red is a red and a white is a white. So the more actively you are engaged visually, the more substance you have in your overall foundation of development, along with all of those other kinds of things. One of my mentors, John Streff, says, when vision is working well, it guides and leads. When it's not working well, it interferes. So vision becomes so important once we get out beyond the point of touch, the point of reach, those things we can reach with their hands. And I call that the circle of understanding. But the how well the baby begins to push out, the developing child begins to push out early on, is a determinant of how easily and how well they may be and effectively they may be able to look up to the chalkboard or marker board or whatever is being projected when they get to be in school. So it has a major influence on everything they will be expected to do later in life.
That's really remarkable. I remember, you know, being an optometry student, starting to hear about these concepts, and it really made me look at children in a completely different way, because I wasn't necessarily thinking, you know, deeply about how, when I'm interacting with children, how their developmental process governs the way that they behave. And so from what you were just explaining, made me think back to, you know, a child, you know, when you're interacting with them, they're fixating on you, on your face. If you hand them something, mm-hmm. they're actually using their vision to really locate where that is, right? And then right. to grab it. And sometimes the first thing they do is put it in their mouth, you know, and so they're trying to get information from it. But it seems that what you're explaining is that at a certain point, once they've retained enough information from actual touch and taste and integrated that with their visual information, that they can then substitute vision for deriving meaning of those things without actually getting to touch them and interact with them physically.
Absolutely. And, you know, I don't want to be heard that vision controls and is everything. It's just we need to understand that vision is so involved in the development of each of these other processes. You know, if you don't reach out beyond what you can physically reach, then you don't stimulate crawling. So it's not just vision, it's that internal drive, that internal curiosity that lets you maintain fixation while you're moving to that target. And then it sets, that sets the stage for so many things later in life. Absolutely. And we, as I said, we intellectually understand that, but we sometimes lose sight of the impact it has on development. And so many babies today are in carriers. The parents put them in carriers. They restrict their movement because of the concern about sudden infant death syndrome. They have to place them on their back in the crib. They don't develop their tummy time. And of course, a part of tummy time is lifting your head and beginning to look up and see what's in that world out there. And so it just becomes so important. The OTs even have a moniker for the kids that are in the containers all the time. And it's container box syndrome. They're just passive. They have low tone, and they just aren't as active in developing. So it just really, really is so impactful in everything we do. And the better we learn to use vision at an early age, then the more effective we're going to be. The good news is most kids learn that process. But there's a greater number now that kids aren't as active and in play and other kinds of things. There's a greater number that needs a boost to help them get over the hump of lack of engagement.
So it seems to me, from what I'm understanding, is that when we're evaluating a child, for example, we're not only looking for visual developmental milestones, but also how those integrate with other developmental milestones, like, for example, motor movement. And especially because, you know, vision and motor are so tightly integrated at that early age that one can affect the other. Can you expand a little bit on kind of how you approach examining some of those things and discussing with parents that connection?
Sure. One of the primary tools I use is my retinoscope, and that's not for refraction. That's used for how well a child is developing their ability to look, point, reach, and move. And a lot of the developmental milestones, I will ask questions indirectly through a survey, through a question and answer process that the parent fills out prior to their visit. But when we see that there are things that are an issue in motor development, or if they're in PT, or if they're in this, or they're getting these other services, then I know vision is involved, whether or not it's noted or not. And too often parents think, oh, well, it can either see or can't see. Many parents think that we should get a dental exam by 6 months of age, and they'll know if they have a vision problem. But the dentist will check, well, how many teeth does a baby have by 6 months of age? None. And I'm not suggesting that kids shouldn't follow a good protocol for a dental exam, but I'm saying they should follow a good protocol for an eye exam too. And so because of the influence of vision, my first look is always with a retinoscope. I call that just look. How are they reaching out visually to reach the target, to touch the target, to look at what happens when I light the target, what happens when I make a sound. As they get a little older, I use pictures, and can they point to the pictures, and how accurately do they find and point to the pictures? All those kinds of things are talking about communication. Pointing is a great communication tool early on, before they can say words. So does the child point? If they don't point to certain things, that gives me an indication they're not able to look as effectively there. I had a baby probably about this time last year who was 2.5 months old, and the parents said there's concern that he's blind. And I started looking with my retinoscope, and it was just very non-responsive and non-reactive. I could get a reflex back, but it was non-responsive and not reactive. Well, if you got a 2.5-month-old child, they're beginning to start looking everywhere. And I don't expect it to be stable like you would a 9-year-old, but I would begin to expect some changes. I got none. And so I said, okay, there's two things we can do here. We can do nothing and assume he's blind, or we can just start some simple things like turn the light on, turn it off. Just get the extremes of stimulation. Mom had 4 other kids, 5 total, and she homeschooled the kids. So she really incorporated a lot of those things at a deeper level. When they came back in 3 months later, 5.5 months old now, as soon as I walked in the door, he looked right up at me. And the retinoscopic reflex was beginning to react to the things I was holding in front of him. He came back again 3 months later. And in the meantime, he had had an MRI, and that it was negative. There were no issues that were initiated there. Came back in at 8.5 months, as I said, looked up at me, laughed, smiled. Retinoscopy bright, open, engaging whatever target I held up. He was accurately looking at that. We were able to get stereo at that point in time. And so, again, I don't want to have the child 8 months of age or 8.5 months of age, 2.5 years of age, and look back and say, well, I wish I'd done something back then. So I think because vision is so integrated with every system, the more we can start. Now, what would have happened had we not done anything at 2.5 months of age? The looking process might not have started. The moving around would not have been as directed. I mean, just getting up on hands and knees is one thing, but crawling to a specific point is a totally different thing. So that's how vision guides and leads through all systems. And all you have to do is watch. So I do it with a retinoscope. You can just watch. You can have the parent watch. And you can see how the child is directing their actions in the room, as they sit in the parent's lap. Just watch. Just look.
That seems like a really remarkable improvement in what seems to be a pretty short amount of time. Can you expand a little bit more on the interventions that you recommended for the parents to take on at home?
What I wanted, of course, was the extreme of light in a dark room, light on and light off, just to move to the extremes. And then I said, you know, if he starts doing this, let's just start having him look at certain things. Play the airplane game when you're feeding. Make sure he's starting to look at the spoon. Talk to him. Look at him in the eye. Have brothers and sisters look him. Get down on the floor with him. Look him in the eye and do those kinds of things. That is a remarkable thing. And of course, what we always talk about is the successes. The next one that comes in may be one that truly has some sort of physical interference that doesn't allow them to see. Unless you truly know that, and even if you do truly know that, my goal is to go ahead and initiate some activities to get as much use of vision and activate that as sufficiently as possible so they'll be able to go there. I don't think the activities we do at these early ages have to be complex. They have to be consistent. Baby has to do something 1,000 times, and that's been documented over and over. A baby has to do something 1,000 times before it becomes a part of their system. If the parent engages the child and gets them to looking and encourages looking, that's the best thing they can do in terms of visual development. But too often, it's just get the food in the mouth as quick as it can. And this is not a gross put down of parents. It's just life is so different now, but it's getting the food in their mouth as quickly as they can. It's getting the device in their hand so they'll be calm, and it's a babysitter, and they don't have to do a number of things. It's pinning them in the container when they go out. So there's just limitations of movement throughout the process of development that creates a reduced engagement in the world around them. But that's how we learn. We learn by reaching out. We learn by doing and take my retinoscope and find out what's the accuracy of how you're reaching my target. I can see you're pointing to it, but are you pointing beyond it? Or are you pointing short? Or where are you? If you're pointing beyond it, I'll see with motion. If you're pointing short, I'll see against motion. But that there are going to be modulations and should be modulations in that throughout the course of development as they settle in and pin down that distance and that target. But by the time they get to be 6 months old or greater, they should be able to pin right in on that target, show very, very minor modulations, and be able to look to another target and be able to accurately fixate there. I can tell whether or not they can do that just by watching the retinoscope, not trying to determine power. That gives me an idea of how they are looking out into the world.
I see. So you're not necessarily as preoccupied about refractive state at that point as you are about how well can they function visually as far as engaging with their environment.
Absolutely. Refraction is a part of everything we do. But the retinoscope, there are a lot of instruments that will give you an accurate assessment of refraction. So I'm not as concerned about the refractive part of it early on, especially as I am how they are looking out in the world and how effective they are in looking out and reaching out into the world.
We're learning so much more about child development, and we're hearing about the importance of things like early childhood education and how much of a difference that makes for children in their later years, the gains that they make at those early ages. But I don't really hear too much about the connection of vision to that process. So can you tell us a little bit more about the role that optometry can kind of expand in that area and what we can be doing to help connect the dots for parents?
I think we need to work to be at the table in our communities, in our cities, in our states, and federally, be sitting at the table when those kinds of decisions are made. It starts with parent, though, and with a child sitting in your chair, and you know that's how all connections are made. It starts and then you see that, and then you begin to reach out in your own development, and you talk to the local Head Start, the local school, the local health department, all the people that have interactions with children. And while we can at state level or national level can give guidelines, we can't go into your local community. We can give you things to help you in your local community, but we can't do that for you. And so there are materials that are available at state level, and many times local societies have them at national level, AOA level. There are materials and things you can use to go in and present PowerPoint presentation. But reaching out and making those connections, starting with the parent in your chair, because parents talk and parents are on social media and you don't know which one is on social media. I remember there's a young doctor in Northern Kentucky that did an infancy assessment on a baby and found significant hyperopia and got the glasses. Well, the baby was too cranky in the office. So mom and dad went down the street to a restaurant to have lunch and tried to put the glasses on the baby there and just happened to be filming it. That was Piper. The video that they eventually posted on Facebook was viewed over 50 million times because she was so cute and she started looking when she got the glasses on that she was not doing before. And the parents were so fascinated by that and their comments. If anybody wants to look it up, Google Piper Can See. It's just incredible. Well, now you've got 50 million people, and who are the majority of people that are looking at that? Most of that is going to be young parents, new parents, who will say, "Whoa, we need to do that." And so that it starts there. And then one of those is going to be connected to an early childhood or an early intervention or some of those communities. Begin to do that in your local community. All it takes is just a presentation, and suddenly you've expanded significantly the information that's available to people who work with these kids every day. It's not that they don't care. It's that they don't know. And if we can just use the resources and the understanding that we have about the visual process, that can be, in my opinion, that can be included in the things that those communities and those organizations present to other parents. And it just really expands the impact that we can have as an individual, as a local society, as a profession.
Absolutely. And I personally remember seeing the Piper video a few years back, and I'm sure most optometrists by now have seen it, and just seeing the ripple effect of that and the reach that something like that got is really inspiring, just to know that, you know, one patient encounter that you have with a patient can really grow, you know, beyond that one-on-one connection and really benefit so many people.
Right. I told a young doctor, I said, you know, you've gone from your small practice, and when I say small, small town practice, to a worldwide stage in 37 seconds. The video was 37 seconds long and worldwide impact. So, yeah.
That's pretty incredible. And I think what's even more incredible is the program that actually was the genesis for that encounter, which was the Infant C program. And I know you've been really involved with that program and really stressed the importance of doctors volunteering time to offer that service to patients and help them get early access into the eye care system. Can you tell us a little bit more about your experience with Infant C and what you've been working on as far as expanding the program and connecting with doctors?
Sure. That has become really a passion since, well, we just got back from the CECO meeting, and that's where the concept was born in 1998. And just laying the groundwork and making the connections and doing all those things, we launched in 2005. And So now we're celebrating 15 years, and just some of it, sometimes it goes by so quickly, and sometimes it just seems like that there are just so many more things still to be done. But the idea is, David Sullins was in a meeting installing his cousin's wife as, at that point in time, it was known as the CECO Auxiliary. As you know, the profession is evolved over time, but then it was primarily the men were the leaders and the auxiliary was the wives group. Well, fortunately, that has evolved, but they were talking about kids having problems at school age. And he came out of that room, and I just happened to be standing there, and he said, "Bubba, they're talking about things at school age. That's too late. What if we were to start doing something in the first year of life?" I said, "David, that's my background. Where do we go?" And so that's where the idea started. And then many, many, many other people began to get involved. And it has evolved into a program where we have a national honorary spokesperson, President Carter, who talks about his two grandchildren who had amblyopia and it wasn't discovered until school age. And then you get all of these other people talking about, well, why wasn't that determined earlier and earlier? So it makes us really, really aware of the importance of identifying early. But if you don't see babies and aren't set up to do that, we all are intellectually, because there's nothing different about examining a baby as there is an older person, except that little thing wiggles in your hands and older people don't. But we're still looking for ocular motility, binocular function, refraction, visual acuity, and ocular health, the same things we look for in a 60-year-old. But in a six-month-old, we have to depend solely on our objective means, whereas we can use subjective means for older patients. We have done that without charge to parent or insurance company to just raise the awareness. And infancy has resources that you can use in your community, in your office, to raise the awareness of the need for early examinations. We request then that the doctor report the basics. Did they have difficulty in ocular motility? Did they have difficulty in binocular function, refraction, visual acuity, and eye health? And if they do, we've got information on that. We have information on over 153,000 babies now. And consistently, 10% of those babies have issues that need to be followed. Now, if 10% have issues that need to be followed, that means the ones that are really, really obvious have already been picked up by the medical caregiver. And so we're still finding 10% above, over and above that number. So it makes us aware of the real need to have early identification, early intervention, and it prevents a lot of the things that we're talking about in the overall process of development. I can still remember the day whenever an AOA staff person called me and they said, listen to this. And it was a mom that had said, I want to thank your infancy program for saving my daughter's life. Said I took her in for her routine exam and a retinoblastoma was discovered. And they removed the eye, but her life was saved. And when a parent tells you that from a program that had just started, been launched 8 months ago, mom was pregnant whenever we launched on the Today Show. Now to have that, it takes on a whole different context. And we know that it's a public health program where we can begin to see that. We've seen so many things, refractive issues, binocular issues, inability to look, ocular motility issues that have not been discovered by any other practitioner. I tell our students, I said, when you walk across the stage at graduation, you're going to know more than anybody else who services babies about vision. And don't back off from that. Be active in doing that and in providing services for these babies.
Absolutely. I definitely agree with you there. And it seems to me that it's not just an entry into care for just that child by essentially removing all barriers and saying it's a no charge exam, bring your child in, we'll do a comprehensive assessment, but it's also an educational opportunity for that whole family where, you know, I'm thinking that a lot of these situations, if the family has heard about infancy for the first time and they're bringing maybe their youngest child, that it's not necessarily uncommon that their older children may have never had their first eye exam either.
Absolutely. If they will trust you with their baby, they'll trust you with any member of their family. And it builds that trust and you become the eye care provider and maybe even the healthcare provider because, you know, in throughout the U.S., there are states that are very rural and you may be the only healthcare provider in miles. You know, okay, they trust you with their baby. They come in and they bring another member of the family and they're diabetic or glaucoma or whatever else. It just raises the awareness of need for eye and healthcare and how much eye is integrated into the rest of everything we do.
Absolutely. Yes. It's one of the things that over time after seeing patients, it just kind of has stood out to me that, you know, with as many babies that are out there, we don't necessarily see as many of them in the practice. And part of that is, you know, making an effort on our part to reach out and kind of instill those habits in the community. But I feel that sometimes that if we haven't had a lot of experience examining young children, that it can seem a little intimidating. So what tips would you have to an optometrist who may be intimidated or doesn't regularly make this a part of their practice to kind of get started on that path?
I would say there's a couple of things. One is if you have more than one exam lane, have all of your equipment for the baby in one room. I'm not saying that your baby, that you only do babies in there, but everything is in one room. So you don't have to go searching for things because that disrupts things. Do everything quickly. A baby is only going to give you so much time, but they keep that amount of time a secret. And so the more you can continually engage them, the longer that time becomes. But if you disrupt by having to go look for something, you narrow that time. So have everything there handy right at your hand. Go over in your mind. We have, within infancy, we have a sheet with all of the minimum expectations in there, and in ocular motility and in binocular function and refraction, you know, that you can sit down and review just prior to going in with the exam. So you'll be familiar with, okay, we've got this. We have some places a list of developmental areas. We have had in the past, these are medications, but that are approved for babies under 1 year of age. There's not very many of those. So you need to be aware if they come in with a red eye. And let me divert there. A red eye is not an infancy assessment. That one is, you take care of that, you bill for that appropriately, and then get them back for the infancy assessment. The infancy assessment is a well child exam, not a problem focused exam. So you take care of the problem, then you get them back in there. And the second thing is, if you have kids of your own, nieces, nephews, neighbors, just interact with them, not in a testing environment, but just an interactive environment, and see what makes babies tick. You don't have to be the expert. What you're looking for in a well child exam is, anything, does anything seem out of the ordinary? And you look back at those guidelines, and if yes, then you can address it as I would. If you're not comfortable, work with a colleague in your area who can address that and who does address that. You know, if you're the person that finds the problem, you are the real hero. If you refer them to me and I resolve the problem, you're still the real hero because you found the problem to begin with. But go in thinking into the exam room, thinking you're just going to play with the kid and have fun. And you'll be surprised at how they'll laugh back at you. Play peekaboo with them. I blow pin lights out in and out. I snap my fingers and make them come on. I sing. Just be yourself, because babies can sense when you're at ease and you're doing things that involve play with them. Babies can also sense when you're afraid and you don't seem to know what to do. They read it even more than parents do. Just go in and be yourself. That to me is the best advice anybody can give you if you're going to see young children. You know, the babies are easier than 2-year-olds. A 2-year-old is like putting an octopus in a sack. You've always got some arm, tentacle, something out somewhere. Babies will sit there and look, and they'll engage with you. And, you know, even putting drops in a baby's eye is so much different. I just lay them down and have them straddle mom, lay them back down in my lap, push their eyes together, put the drops in, and as soon as you remove your hand, boom, their eyes open, their drops fall in. Much, much easier than trying to catch a 2-year-old to put the drops in there. So, you know, just find ways that you can have fun with them, because they'll have fun back with you.
And for some of our listeners who are interested in kind of broadening their knowledge base on this and learning more about developmental optometry, what resources would you recommend as far as books, articles, conferences, workshops?
My go-to book is Gazelle's Visionist Development, Infinite Child. It was originally published in 1949. But the guy was such a forward thinker that the concepts then are good today. However, the most recent edition was published in 2018, and I was privileged to write the foreword to that. And so it's available through the Optometric Extension Program, Visionist Development in Infant and Child, and it just carries you all the way through those first 5 years of life. I look at articles outside of optometry and eye care and try to determine how they fit in those aspects. Science Daily is a great, great resource to have. You go online and you select the particular areas you want. I select child development, I select eye care, and I select autism, which is another one of my areas of interest. But I get articles from every profession known to man come through there. But they're you have to filter it down, because it would be way too much just to go in and try to find something. But you filter it down. And those are articles that are, well, I'll say 95% outside the profession of optometry. Conferences and workshops. COVD, College of Optometrists and Vision Development. Education there is outstanding. The OEP curriculum courses, education is outstanding. There are other individuals, a couple of friends of mine who put on individual courses in either in your office or in your locale for small groups, so you can get started there. Academy, AOA, CECO, GWECO, all your regional organizations will generally have something on child development there, or children, pediatrics, which is a start. I'll be doing one on a course on autism and another on digital devices. The title of that is Digital Devices, the Good, the Bad, the Ugly, because it is good, but there's also things that we have to be concerned about. So courses at your major organizations, it's there. It's just a matter of finding the place that's suitable for you, that you'll be able to do that.
Yeah, and I'm sure folks can keep in touch with you online to kind of learn a little bit more about that. Would there be some social media handles or platforms that they can look you up on?
On Facebook, just Glenn T. Steele. Instagram, you can follow me. LinkedIn, I'm on, so you can follow me there. It's G Steele, that's with an E, G-S-T-E-E-L-E, at sco.edu.
Excellent. And we'll make sure to include that in text, as well as your other social media handles here with the companion post here with the podcast as well. And hopefully we're getting some folks who are interested in branching out and learning a little bit more. And also we'll include some links to the resources that we had mentioned as well. And I definitely wanted to thank you for making time to chat with us today, Dr. Steele, and really appreciate the opportunity to pick your brain about a lot of things that I've been personally curious about. And I've always been a fan of the lectures of yours that I've had a chance to attend, and think I'll be attending the future ones with a renewed perspective. So thank you so much, and I really appreciate your time.
You're very welcome, and I enjoyed it. Thank you.
That's a wrap for this episode, but it's only the beginning of the conversation. Please share your thoughts with us in the comment section on odsonfacebook.com, as well as in the ODs on Facebook group. If you have questions for our guests that you feel the whole community would benefit from learning the answers to, then please share those in the comments as well. Our guests will be jumping in the comments to continue the discussion with the community. And if you enjoyed the podcast, make sure you subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher by searching for ODs on Facebook podcast. Thanks, everyone, and we'll catch you on the next episode.